Good morning, everybody. I think I summoned everybody by standing up at the music stand. I feel more comfortable up here. Welcome, a warm welcome to everybody. Thank you for being here for Poetry Matters and Carolyn Levine. I will begin with some introductory remarks, and then we'll segue into some comments on Carolyn Levine's superb book, Forms. So I'm Miranda Hickman. I'm an associate professor in the Department of English at McGill, and I'm also this year acting associate dean for student affairs for the Faculty of Arts. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Carolyn Levine on behalf of Poetry Matters. The English department at McGill is delighted that you're here. But I will also surface that at Poetry Matters, we're especially pleased that you're here, because what you're doing with an exciting new formalism rhymes closely with what we've been trying to do as a group. Because for Poetry Matters, for the group that I'll say a little bit more about, form matters and forms matter. So Poetry Matters lobbied to invite Carolyn Levine to McGill. I'll point to that. She came yesterday, as many of you know, for the annual Spectre Lecture for the Department of English, for which she gave a wonderfully thought-provoking talk yesterday, focused, among other things, on sustainable aesthetics. And we're grateful that she's accepted our further invitation to this roundtable. And I'll just clarify, we won't ask much of you today except active listening. And thank you, because we have a few rejoinders to your book, Forms. So we'll ask just for your listening and your responses. So I want to say a little bit about Poetry Matters, which I co-facilitate with my colleague Michael Nicholson in the Department of English. The group, as many of you know, came into being about 2 years ago as a forum, or one might say a form, for events around poetry and creating community around a shared interest in poetry from different angles. I also understand that it's been said of the Department of English at McGill, which is primary home for Poetry Matters, that nearly everybody in the English department is a formalist of one kind or another. I've heard this. So maybe we can address that and unpack that a little bit later. But what this gestures toward are the diverse ways in which one can do formalism and lay claim to what's called a formalist approach. And maybe this topic can come into play during the Q&A. So Carolyn Levine is David and Kathleen Ryan Professor of Humanities at Cornell University, where she is currently, and kudos to you, chair of the Department of English, as I understand it, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And to say something about her book, Forms, since its publication in 2015, her book, Forms, has ignited rich response and conversations. There was an issue of PMLA, for instance, devoted to rejoinders from various quarters. People took pleasure in mixing it up with the inspiring ideas that the book offered, indicating its impact. She is also author of Serious Pleasures of Suspense, Victorian Realism and Narrative Doubt, which was awarded the Perkins Prize for the Best Book in Narrative Studies. And she's also devoted much of her work to asking how and why the humanities and the arts matter, especially in democratic societies. As my colleague Tabitha Sparks noted yesterday at the Spectre Lecture, Levine moves with ease and agility among literary studies, philosophy, and cultural studies, as she shows in her book Forms, which with intentional range spans from the poetry of Elizabeth Barrett Browning to Charles Dickens to Sophocles to HBO's The Wire. So in Forms, for those of you who don't know the book, and the book is entitled Forms, Whole, Rhythm, Hierarchy, Network, Levine seeks to trace various forms in the name of finding sites for emancipatory transformative political work. So maybe this is one of the things that we can address today, how form can do that. As David Allworth notes in the LA Review of Books, Forms is, quote, less a defense than a redesign of formalism.
As he says, Levine doesn't call for a return to old school aesthetic appreciation and apolitical close reading as a way to curb historicism run amok. Instead, he says, as many critics have done before her, she looks beyond her discipline for a way around the whole formalism-historicism debate. Unquote. So Levine opens her book with the possibility that we might use methods associated with older literary formalisms, such as close reading, to parse and analyze social experience through its forms. So this is the possibility that she traces out toward political efficacy. And among the luminous concepts she offers are that forms do work in the world. As she notes in her introductory work for the book, forms constrain, differ, overlap and interact, they travel, and they do political work in particular historical contexts. So you assign verbs to form in some fascinating ways. And she also launches a wonderfully generative term drawn from design theory, and I hope you can speak more to this today, affordances. To get at, as I understand it, the work, the capacities latent in forms and materials, so affordances. And I just want to conclude this introduction by pointing to something that my colleague Will Straw at McGill has noted. He's in art history and communication studies, and he was very sorry he couldn't be here today. He's traveling. But he noted to me the other day, he said, I found her book to be one of the best accounts I've read recently about why form is important. And why an attention to it need not lead us back into the pitfalls of older formalism. So, and actually, one of the things I'm going to be speaking to today in my remarks is older formalism. And I'll see about those pitfalls. Will we fall into them? So the way things will work today is that the four of us at the round table will each meditate for about 10 to 12 minutes on your work. And we'll sum up with a question to you, which you need not answer right away, but we'll hold questions, I think, until after the remarks. And then we'll open things up to questions from you. I want to tell you a little bit about who we are. Many of you in the room know, but just a gesture toward the round table. Shandeep Banerjee is Associate Professor of English at McGill. He works on both 19th and 20th century literature, especially on post-colonial and world literatures, and he works on form. I understand that there's work in the offing, actually, on form. Mm-hmm. His new book, forthcoming this year, is Space, Utopia, and Indian Decolonization, Literary Prefigurations of the Post-Colony. Mm-hmm. Prashant Kenchakmurthy is Associate Professor of Iranian-Persian Studies at McGill's Institute for Islamic Studies. He's published very recently in Essays on Form, Manner, and the Stylistics of Metaphor in Persian and Indo-Persian Literatures, and he's also a gifted translator. Michael Nicholson is Assistant Professor in the Department of English, where he specializes in British Romanticism, especially poetry, focusing on lyric, ecology, and the intriguing concepts of lyric defiance and anachronism. His book in progress is After Time, Romanticism and Anachronism. And I'm Miranda Hickman, and I'm Associate Professor of English at McGill. I specialize in modernism and modernist poetry. I'm author of The Geometry of Modernism. I'm co-editor of Rereading the New Criticism, and most recently The Classics in Modernist Translation. And as you'll tell from my remarks, I'm interested in the development of criticism and formalism in the 20th century, and especially the history of this discipline we still call, I think in a bit of a misnomer, English. So that's how I'll contextualize your work today. So I'm talking a lot to begin with. Let me lead off with my meditation, and then I'll pass things on to others. So this is a meditation, a kind of wishful lyric meditation, and a kind of manifestic probe of sorts, as spurred by Levine's book. I've been inspired by Carolyn Levine's turn back to forms and formalism, as someone who's followed the history of 20th century formalisms, gravitations toward and away from formalisms in the course of the 20th century.
And I'm interested in what motivates the turn or return to form in different instances, what drives refusals thereof. Why do we become culturally invested in form at different moments? Levine's book features a new formalism. I've spent a good bit of time lingering in the disciplinary attic of the field we still call English, sifting among old formalisms, such as that of Cleanth Brooks' fabled American New Critic. And among approaches of other early 20th century critics, I uncouple from the new critics, such as I.A. Richards and Kenneth Burke. What impels people to commit or recommit to form at different cultural junctures? For the American New Critics, this commitment often emerged from an effort to move to criticism and away from historical scholarship that, for them, unfortunately didn't attend to the text as crafted object, as work of art, and from an effort to engage in close reading so as to get to aesthetics. And for them, important was asserting the specificity of the literary. They wanted to suggest that the laws and languages by which literature proceeded, especially poetry, were different, excitingly different, from those at work in ordinary language, one might say prosaic language. So I'm interested in answering Levine's model of formalism with another new formalism that moves in a somewhat different direction, one inspired by my finds in the cultural archives, and one meant to foster readings that bring us back to the individual poem. Not surprisingly, you'll find me standing up for the individual poem. And to what old formalists sometimes called the texture of a poem, what cannot be paraphrased, to what my colleague Prashant calls ambient textuality, and what my colleague Michael Nicholson calls the density and opacity of lyric. So I want to go back there. And I also want to go to how form makes us feel. I'm also interested, through cultural historians such as Gerald Graff and John Guillory, in surfacing the disciplinary forces that have often given formalism such a bad name in our fields in recent years, and that have even prompted what I read as a kind of disciplinary flight for many years in many neighborhoods from close reading, at least a wariness about committing sustained attention to the individual text, and for me, often poem, and to what it gives distinctively, without a sense of guilt, especially in public. So the LA Review of Books has said of Levine's book, Levine doesn't call for a return to old school aesthetic appreciation and apolitical close reading, nor do I. But I do call for an unashamed move to close reading the individual poem and to aesthetics, to sensory and conceptual engagement and the intertwining of the two with a text's form and beauty. Levine's new formalism is exciting. It's tremendously exciting. It's a bold step. It's a courageous step. And what compels it at this moment? Levine reaches for new instruments for political intervention, for what I take to be canny formalist readings and cultural diagnoses that might allow us to make change and get to a world that's more just. And the book, again, has made waves, in part because it touches a disciplinary nerve through its attention to form. Why it causes such a stir, I think, is its crucial reclamation of formalism for our times. So what you do with formalism brushes valuably against the grain of many of the disciplinary habits we've accrued, some of which you spoke to yesterday eloquently. So what are these habits? As Susan Wolfson notes in 2006 in her collection Reading for Form, as part of her stocktaking of how formalism was regarded at the end of the 20th century, reading for form, she noted at that point, was decidedly retro and not glamorously so. It was out of fashion. As Susan Wolfson says, though some of us have never stopped reading for form, the practice in general, as a disciplinary love, devotion, and commitment, had gone underground or out to the margins. It was an aggrieved, counter-hegemonic coterie, remnant of an earlier critical heyday, either at odds with sociocultural critique,
or, if added into its mix, usually put there to expose complicity with dominant oppressions and false consciousness. Yet, that said, given the inventory that Susan Wolfson offers, as Shandip Banerjee notes, despite what this implies, there have continued to be many unrecognized formalists prominent in our field, such as Frederick Jameson. We often just haven't acknowledged them as such because of formalism's bad rap in our disciplinary climate. Then, subsequent to the turn of the 20th century, there's been a renewed commitment to form and formalisms in which Levine's work participates. And for what reasons, for what stakes? I'd like to exploit the disciplinary moment of opportunity Levine's work crucially identifies and work from there. So what do we mean by form? The phrase that surfaced for me in response to Levine was one that W.B. Yeats once used, which still enjoys purchase in modernist studies: stylistic arrangements of experience. And this, for me, resonated with your subtle arrangements of words and images, and then in other domains, other elements. Recently, I followed the work of people like Joseph North, who, in Literary Criticism, calls for a return to criticism and an attention to aesthetics in literary criticism. North's work, like Levine's, but by a different path, visits what's often been constructed as the battle days of early 20th century literary criticism, associated with figures such as Brooks and Richards. North seeks to push beyond what he sees as the dominance and limitations of a contextual historicist paradigm for scholarship in the field of English. He says that this has really taken hold especially since the 80s and 90s. And he wants to move past this to a renewed emphasis on criticism and aesthetics. And he's interested in how this might allow us to choose new possible future pathways for the field. So I want to speak to the relationship between North's work and your work and some of the things that I've been thinking. North's work suggests that we might revisit beneficially through historical analysis some of the reasons that it came to be seen as conservative, even retrograde and head in the sand, to focus on aesthetics, to pursue criticism and engage in close reading for form. How did it gather this kind of reputation? In North's reading, there are still many problematic assumptions in play about the conservative politics associated with formalist approaches. And this is what you're trying to press against as well, that we need not think of the politics associated with formalist approaches as conservative in that older way. So for him, these still stand in need of interrogation and overturn so that we can now reach in good conscience to the possibilities that such formalist analysis can afford. But again, the question for me is always, what do we have to get past to get there? And I think this is what you've been reckoning with as well. So Levine's work, likewise, importantly reconsiders such older models of formalism. So cued by both Levine and Joseph North, I'll descend briefly into the cultural archives. And like North, I go back beyond the New Critics per se. We often mention the New Critics. They have become the most fabled. But I want to go back to the work of I.A. Richards, who in Britain was a crucial precursor for what the New Critics subsequently built more thinly, I think. Richards introduced the concept of practical criticism into British context particularly, and began to offer in the 20s strategies for close reading, partly for form, but more importantly, for cues and arrangements in a text, especially a poem for him, that for I. Richards yielded finely organized experience for the reader, an experience of balanced structure through engagement with the text that in turn gave rise to finer organization of impulses in readers' minds than one could ordinarily experience. So for him, that was the yield, that was the payoff. And this, for Richards, left one better coordinated and equipped for life. For Richards, it was aesthetic experience that fostered such a welcome coordination, and what Richards read as training for what he called, strikingly, the mind of the future. When I work with this in a course that I teach on in the 20th century criticism, people sort of like that, you know, that glamorous Tsarist term, the mind of the future. And you get to it through training in aesthetic experience. He says, in this very nonchalant way, in the middle of Principles of Literary Criticism, everybody knows the feeling of freedom, of relief, of increased competence and sanity
that follows any reading in which more than usual order and coherence has been given to our responses. So that's Richards in 1924. And then as part of my descent into the cultural archives, I would also point briefly to Kenneth Burke, so around the edges of the New Critics in the United States, who followed the psychological and emotional effects of form on readers. So with such older formalisms in mind, I'd like to build renewed justification for attending closely to the finely crafted text, such as the individual poem, combing through it, unashamed, for details, lexicon, patterns, images, but not only so as to fetishize it, not only to celebrate with relief the way it creates order and unity where there might be disorder, because that's often what the older formalists looked for. Instead, I'd rather do so to recognize what the crafted individual text gives distinctively as formed, as different from the ideas and elements that inform. Through the way that it remediates and reforms these and displays and deploys these in synergistic array. And then I'd like to recognize how the text's synergistic formal effects can form our responses and transform us as readers. I don't necessarily want to go in the direction that I. Richards does toward the mind of the future, although maybe that would be exciting. But I do want to ask about how form, as we engage with it closely, can transform us as readers. So I'd step to a formalism that engages intentionally in close reading without the embarrassment about lingering on the individual poem that we so often now have built into our disciplinary reflexes, because I think we do. Not always in the classroom, but I think we do. I do think we've been brought to a disciplinary juncture whereby we're pressed to feel a reflex of embarrassment and engaging in close reading in individual text alone. So despite many calls in recent years, and I'm aware of them, for a return to close reading, my sense is that in actual public practice, it still remains, close reading of that kind remains a kind of queer abject as disciplinary practice. So I'll toss that out there as a probe to see if, you know, see what people think. So I'd move to an approach that doesn't shy from the individual poem, that instead stays with it, commits to it, calls and calls out the distinctive world of thought and feeling it generates through form, thinks about how it refracts the materials it imports from the world, and asks about how its patterns, lexicon, its forms make us feel, how they can affect and transform us, and how they can make us travel and reach and evolve beyond our ordinary selves. We're changed by reading form. Kenneth Burke once commented on an emotional curve prompted by the ride through a form, such as a narrative sequence, a lyric poem, the shape of an episode. What difference does it make when we encounter a moment of Lily Briscoe's pain at the end of an episode rather than the beginning, as an answer to expectations raised by the opening of a scene? What do we know and feel differently about that pain through formal placement? If in a sonnet by Millais we encounter the idea of a woman remaining silent about lyric feeling and grief, how do we know and feel that grief through form, through cues that draw our attention to it repeatedly, build toward its disclosure, and make us aware of the rarity of a woman expressing pain in the context and history of the sonnet? So if Levine, in a way that I think of as almost Northrop Frye, and that was meant to get a rise out of you, discovers patterns that cross and travel through individual texts, as you may not agree, like cultural archetypes, I'm interested right now, at least in a converse move, of burrowing within individual poems again, but not for shelter and not for retreat, instead for what we know and feel differently through such fine-grained, stubborn, deep focus on the sensory experience, the aesthetic experience of the individual text. So, and this is my last salvo. As Levine's work suggests, we might be in search of new forms of political agency. As you say, the most strategic political action begins with understanding forms and ends with the reordering of things. I'd suggest that another form of such agency, adjacent to hers, might be formed by casting ourselves through close reading for form into alternative worlds that individual poems can conjure.
by entering into alternative states of mind and structures of feeling that individual texts can elicit. So I'm drawing on Ian Richards and Kenneth Burke and now Charles Altieri to imagine a reach through engagement with form to the alterity of a poem in a way that transforms us beyond who we usually are. So Richards is interested in how close reading focuses and forms the mind and feeling, and so am I. And I'd suggest that it's fine-grained engagement with the text as formed, the form of a text, that can bring us to such transformation for the reader. And I'll close with a quotation from Terry Eagleton, who at one point in his work mischievously addresses close reading through Nietzsche, the philologist. Because I just want to think about forms of political agency that are available through close reading for form. As Eagleton puts it, close reading for Nietzsche is a critique of modernity. To attend to the feel and form of words is to refuse to treat them in a purely instrumental way, and thus to refuse a world in which language is worn to a paper-like thinness by commerce and bureaucracy. So close reading for form, for me, allows us to perform such refusals and to ready our minds and feelings for such refusals in the name of other affirmations. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thanks very much. So I'll pass things on to Prashant. Yeah. Do you want to come up here?
Yeah. Be easier. Okay. I might take a little less time.
Took a lot of time.
Okay, so I'd like to begin by thanking Professor Levine for her thought-provoking book, which I teach in Islamic studies, and I teach literature, and that's my own discipline, and teaching as I do there, I find this book was a refreshing methodological break from reading practices that, at least in Islamic studies, are largely still indebted to area studies models of philological expertise, right? So you typically, there's an all too mechanical way in which literary scholars of Persian, Urdu, or the other Middle Eastern, South Asian literatures and languages set a text, mediating its author's intentions within a historically mediated context to then consider how text and context affect each other. There's a kind of mechanical predictability to it. Whereas Karan Levine's book, or Book-Length Meditation, led me to consider the prospect of treating textual and non-textual forms as equally real and as affecting each other in ways autonomous of authorial consciousness. That's the kind of, for me, the nub of the book. This, it strikes me, is also distinct to the post-structuralist thesis of limitless semiosis, because rather than attending to the dissolution of textual boundaries by the slippage of signifiers, the book rests on the claim that forms traverse texts and phenomena other than texts equally, thus allowing us a point of vantage other than just signs on how texts relate to the social. As I understand her, Levine takes form to be a relation. A relation, as we know, is never just any one of its terms, empirical or ideal, actual or imagined, but what connects them all. It's this understanding of relation, an understanding that brackets out questions of a mode of a term's existence in favor of the logic connecting it with other terms, that allows her to practice and prescribe an attention to forms that does not distinguish between texts and churches, texts and countries, texts and economies, texts and TV series, and so forth. This entails sometimes treating a text as the intentional or unintentional site of conflict between different modes of relation, different forms. But this does raise the question, at least for me, of whether texts, literary or otherwise, a novel or a double entry register, a sonnet or a laundry bill, possess any privileged place in the social, since any other site within the social could equally manifest conflicts of form. Why, if at all, should we then assign any privileged place to literary texts? Are we not left where Claude Lévi-Strauss and Richard Rorty leave us, with a call to direct towards all phenomena, literary texts, rainforests, films, wrestling matches, Nambikwara pottery shards, rocks and quarks, and attention to how they might serve our particular ends with their affordances? If so, then the literary text surely possesses no privilege as an encryption of forms over other sites of culture. This might not be a problem, but for the fact that what distinguishes an artwork, I think, or a novel, or a poem, or a film, is that unlike documentary texts, unlike a laundry bill, a deed of sale, and unlike non-artistic practices, like a wrestling match or driving, it encrypts two kinds of intention, workly and authorial. We discern workly intention, or the intention of the work, in its genre signals. Much of what Miranda spoke of, I think, concerns this. In its genre signals, its shape on the page, its syntax and choices of imagery. In other words, by the familiar dispersal of marks that we learn to respect as constraints on our interpretation. We distinguish this intention from that of the author, if we choose to, by arguing that such marks and patterns they form pre-existed the author, who only manipulated them, or that they are amenable to interpretations autonomous of what the author may have had in mind. Either kind of intention, workly or authorial, constrains what would otherwise be interpreted anarchy. Disrespecting such constraints, as John Ruskin's Women Readers, this is a wonderful reading of John Ruskin's Sesame and Lilies that appears early in the book, disrespecting such constraints as John Ruskin's Women Readers disrespected his paternalistic prescriptions leads to what we might approve of politically, but would characterize, I think, hermeneutically after Umberto Eco as use rather than interpretation. A history of such uses of texts rather than a history of their interpretations would, I wager, be a history of anarchic appropriations. But what's wrong, one might argue, with interpretive anarchy if it allows us, like it allowed Lester Fremont, Bunny Colvin, and Omar Little? These are the characters from The Wire with whom the book ends, who Levine calls, quote, the ethical and epistemological exemplars, unquote, of The Wire, to, quote, recognize the power and significance of multiple forms, unquote, and thus, quote, permits outcomes that frustrate or elude the conventional distribution of power, unquote. A problem I see is that such instrumentalization of forms and formal conflicts implies that accident or the aleatory, it's a recurrent word, almost a term in this book, that such accidents or the aleatory is all that a reader interested in freedom from whatever kind of oppression can hope for. Does it not suggest that readers committed to justice of whatever kind can only emulate the kind of street smartness we see in the three characters from The Wire, Levine upholds, for making the best of an accident of formal collisions? The reader, this reader who resembles Levi-Strauss's bricoleur, hijacks whatever forms lie to hand to emancipate herself, or himself, in ways and for ends, independent of authorial and workly intention, and of literary history. How would such a reader strategize? Indeed, how could political strategy even be possible if all the space available to us results only from accidental clearings between and betwixt forms? Furthermore, does such interpretive instrumentalism not implicitly grant equal legitimacy to conservative instrumentalizations of formal conflicts? The conservative section of Iran's clergy were, quote, canny formalists, unquote, when they appropriated what were formal conflicts between the binarisms and hierarchisms within the People's Revolution of 1979. Hindu nationalists instrumentalized a formal conflict between the hierarchies of pre-colonial, sectarian, scholastic exegeses of the Bhagavad Gita and the wholes of literal-minded European Orientalist interpretations of the same text to turn the text into a universally available prescription for ethically irresponsible rule-following. This is happens from the late 19th century onwards. The Nazis exploited a collision of two kinds of wholes, the whole of Nietzsche's published work and the whole of his unpublished work, to concoct a version of the philosopher that suited their ideology. How might reading that is attentive to the emancipatory possibilities and collisions of forms preempt such oppressive readings? I'd like to close by suggesting that two related solutions might lie in converting the particular analyses of text that Levine offers in her book from thought experiments into denser exercises in literary criticism. I mean, I wasn't sure of the hermeneutic status of these, of the several readings, many of which are very, very exciting. My favorite was the reading of Dickens's Bleak House in the chapter Networks. I wasn't sure of whether these were, in a sense, thought experiments and therefore had allegorical value, generalizable value, or whether they were exercises in literary criticism. And I tend to think they're more thought experiments than literary criticism. And so one solution might be to sort of press the literary critical or to lean on the literary critical character or tendency of these readings. And then secondly, in working with non-realist texts too. I think it's because she assigns each particular engagement with the text the value of a thought experiment, largely, that questions of genre and content perhaps interest her less than the pragmatic usefulness of forms. Passing lightly over questions of genre and modes of mimesis and particular stylistic traits permits the generalizability of furia, after all. But what if attention to a text's generic status, its author's prosodic choices and dynamics of theme, so embedded it in its ambient textual and social world that oppressive appropriations of it, such as the examples I gave, would only be shown up for their methodological mistakenness? And secondly, what if, therefore, Levine's many examples included not just realist texts and TV series, but also non-realist ones? Would non-realist texts, say a Marquez novel, or a Kafka story, or Rumi's Masnavi, or Eliot's Wasteland, or Beowulf, trip up attempts to reduce them to their affordances? Do realist novels, poems, plays, and TV series not allow literal readings of holes, rhythms, hierarchies, and networks? And if so, are they not, for this reason, convenient proving grounds for formal conflicts in ways that non-realist or irrealist modes of mimesis might make inconvenient? Is, for example, Melville's White Whale a hole because it is a singular product of Ahab's obsession, or a network because it is all things to all sailors who dwell upon it? Could its elusiveness imply a hierarchy of superficial and deep knowledges, or a rhythm of surrogate whales?
I do have a handout. I couldn't help but bring in some poems. Sorry. Take this opportunity to thank Caroline Levine for being here and engaging with us about form, and this has already been a very productive session for me. And I would like to thank my colleagues for kind of interesting coffee discussing your book that's generated many ideas in me as well, so I have to pay those debts. And also to another member who helped bring you here and plan, Yale Halevi Wise, who was part of our original planning of this event. So thank you, Yale, as well. Okay, so inspired by Caroline Levine's book, I've created my own four keywords, which I hope will revise and extend and engage with this fascinating thesis. So I'm calling this poetic information, inform, reform, unformed, formless, in dialogue with forms, whole, rhythm, hierarchy, network. So this talk takes Caroline Levine's book as an invitation to conduct a thought experiment of my own about form and its discontents, or put another way, the antonyms and etymological allies of forms. My initial reflections are prompted in part by Levine's own rich discussion of the HBO television series The Wire, specifically her discussion of overlapping, contacting, and colliding forms and societal structures, many of which relate to information and intelligence, gossip and surveillance networks, and on it goes. Besides discussing how the series generates suspense through missing crucial pieces of information, Levine states, and this is number one, information too has power, and it too moves along network paths. Phone calls among drug dealers prompt the detective's desire for wiretapping technology to reveal the structure of the drug business, and gossip and informants provide crucial hinges between police and drug dealers when the wiretap fails. Taking Levine's call to explore the latent possibilities of form seriously, I want to ask what further reflections on forms might Levine's forms be affording or making possible. What I want to meditate on here is an intellectual thread that remains latent and implicit in Levine's book that I would like to draw out. As Levine herself notes, number two, The Wire makes clear that children at Tilghman Middle School do not begin outside of political forms and institutions and move into them as they mature. Rather, we see how even before birth, the patterns of family and school are already meeting and informing one another, and how both are rerouted and reshaped in encounters with electoral politics, drug trafficking, police administration, social services, and the law. As this passage implies, Levine expertly theorizes form's ability to reroute, reorganize, and reshape. What I'm struck by here, however, is her reference to the ways in which forms inform one another. Mm-hmm. Thinking about how forms inform one another, how forms of communication and exchange mediate the social events of The Wire, allows us to build on Levine's account to consider a distinction between form and one of its usual antagonists, content. If content signifies that which is conveyed or expressed, tenor, import, meaning, substance, sense, then thinking about the ways in which form informs, or the ways in which form is information, might seem bizarre or radical. This is where turning to the etymological history of the terms inform and information can actually be instructive. Indeed, when our information What we kind of forget in our information age is that the history of these terms takes us to an unlikely place. Not media, but poetry. Not content, but form. While form could at one time mean to mold by discipline or education, to train, instruct, this sense is now rare, except in reference to forming the mind. Similarly, as a verb, form can mean to bring into being, to conceive, to impart knowledge of a subject, doctrine, method, action, to give instruction in, or even just to teach. And she speaks to pedagogy in interesting ways. One definition of information that we don't recall very often, and this is from the OED, is to give form or determinate character to. To give determinate character to, see form. You look up inform or information, it's telling you this is the same thing as form, go see that, right? Hence, to imbue or impregnate with a specific quality or attribute, to impart some pervading quality or spirit to. I don't think we think of form as imparting something into a container. That's actually what we think of as something else, right? To fill or affect the mind or heart with a feeling, thought, etc. To inspire, again, see form. So as the OED's definition of inform makes clear, inform is to give form to put into shape, to put into form, to put into material form or shape, to form, shape, mold, fashion, even to create, to put into proper form or order. And then it says, which I love, now rare, chiefly only in poetic use. Right? So there's something about that's only in poetry now, right? That definition. These definitions of inform, as I said, refer to the definition of form. Form as the essential determinant principle of a thing, that which makes anything matter a determinate species or kind of being, the essential creative quality. And so I was interested, I looked into Johnson's dictionary, and when you look up inform in Johnson's dictionary, inform signifies not only pedagogy, to instruct, to supply with knowledge, to acquaint, but, and then the more nefarious, which is interesting, to offer an accusation to a magistrate, but also, and listed first, when you look up inform, to animate, to actuate by vital powers. Not only are the imbricated histories of the term inform and form significant insofar as they allow us to consider the ways in which form itself includes knowledge and its in communication as much as shape, but also the ways in which form could function as content, could fill, inspire, and inspirit. Returning to this definition is significant not only for the ways in which it generates an idea of poetry and its forms as productive of information and knowledge, but also for the ways in which this definition helps us to glimpse the power of Levine's thesis, that forms move and travel, that they are portable and transhistorical, always already on the move. Here a few examples might be helpful. And speaking of the famed 19th century British poet Felicia Hemans' writing, Letitia Landon plays on these two definitions of form, inform, information, to signal the ways in which the poetic creation forms informs us of a world, and this is exactly, interestingly, what Miranda was talking about, that also always already instructs or informs. This is Landon. The keen feeling, the generous enthusiasm, the lofty aspiration, and the delicate perception are given but to make the possessor unfitted for her actual position. It is well. Such gifts, in their very contrast to the selfishness and the evil with which they are surrounded, inform us of another world. They breathe of their home, which is heaven, the spiritual and the inspired in this life, but to fit us to believe in that which is to come. And so I'm interested, too, in how in Childe Harold, Byron speaks of this kind of material poetic information. He says, the unreached paradise of our despair, which o'er-informs the pencil and the pen. Informing the pencil. And Keats' famous letter to Woodhouse in this context is actually kind of interesting to return to. Theorizes, a poet is the most unpoetical of anything in existence because he has no identity. He is continually in for, and there's always these footnotes in the Norton, for example, that say, what he means by in for is inform, right? He is continually in for, informing, and filling some other body. The sun, the moon, the sea, and men and women who are creatures of impulse are poetical and have about them an unchangeable attribute. The poet has none, no identity. He is certainly the most unpoetical of all God's creatures, etc. Seeing the capacity of form newly, we might turn to the well-known conclusion of Tintern Abbey, even, which, like Landon and Keats, transforms older material, even Edenic ideas of humankind as informed clay, to a material ecological information, poetry as pedagogy, form as content. Knowing that, this is number 5, knowing that nature never did betray the heart that loved her, 'Tis her privilege through all the years of this our life to lead from joy to joy. For she can so inform the mind that is within us, so impress with quietness and beauty, and so feed with lofty thoughts that neither evil tongues, rash judgments, nor the sneers of selfish men." It goes on. So thinking of form as animation, as vitality, terms which Johnson's dictionary binds inseparably to life itself as animation. Here we might think of poetry's own historical connections to transportation, being moved, transports, flights of fancy, etc. Brings me to my second line of inquiry, which relates to the ways in which Levine's study engages the material aspects of form. If we think with recent work in eco-criticism, we can think too about the ways in which poetry animates, right? That this idea of a kind of materiality to the voice as animating. So a few kind of lines of questioning to end up with. What is the relationship of form and content that Levine's forms articulates? Can turning to the histories of these terms destabilize the boundaries of what counts as form versus content? Where and when is form content possibly? Added to this, what are the antonyms of form? Form appears to have many discontents. How can forms, others, and antonyms throw into relief what we mean by form when we think about form today? Well, we might think about content, right? Or we might think about the informal, even the unformed. And if you look at unformed etymologically, it says lack of knowledge. So it's almost the opposite of what I'm talking about, right? So form as knowledge or unformed as lack of knowledge. The reverse of what I've discussed in terms of information. Might we also query formlessness as an antonym, which Levine herself discusses, and this is number 6. We have therefore learned to look for places where the binary breaks down or dissolved, generating possibilities that turn the form into something more ambiguous and ill-defined, formless. Scholars in recent years have written a great deal about indeterminate spaces and identities, employing such key terms as liminality, borders, migration, hybridity, and passing. This work has been compelling and politically important without any doubt, and it will surely continue to be productive to analyze formal failures, incompletion, and indefinability. As I have sought to show with inform and information, extending Levine's insights into the ways in which forms and forms of organization overlap and collide, we might consider form's allies in adjacent terms, the forms of the term form, and how they too throw in relief what we talk about when we talk about form. Here I'm thinking about a rich vocabulary that activates many of the concerns that Levine discusses, from the ways in which terms like uniform and conformity signal capitalistic production and monotony, to the ways in which reform captures both political adjustments and formless kind of adjustments as well that Levine articulates. Finally, taking a cue from Coleridge, one of the other things I want to ask in relation to form materiality is what distinctions and affordances might be made for organic versus inorganic forms, forms of life, and machine forms. What is the role of the author in the individual life and forms? Related to this, what distinctions might we draw between forms that are inherent in materials and forms that derive from the conjunction of forms and materials? What Levine terms the potential uses or actions latent in designed materials. Put another way, are forms inherent to materials, or do they require other forms to emerge, a doing of work, the knife must cut something, etc.? Do forms suggest a static or dynamic view of materiality, and do they relate more to the organizing principle or to the organized thing, right? Form or forms plural, which is an interaction. I think that's why the book is plural, right? Which is interesting. Here I think, again, of sort of new concepts of materiality, returns to Lucretius and Spinoza, and something that's formed, a body, is actually always on the move, particles being exchanged, the form not so kind of bounded, right? Which kind of seems to be interesting in relation to what you're talking about. Here I'm also thinking of Levine's own discussion of something like Dickinson, in another kind of way, right? Could we think about not only the interactions between forms, but between forms and the formless, or between bounds and the boundless, right? The finite and the infinite, the formless and the formed, etc. How do those come into contact? That's another kind of extension, right? Because when you talk about Dickinson, we think about something like Lyric as this kind of boundless container, right? Short but boundless, dense but infinite, fragmented, but complete. This is what Miranda's talking about again, in a way, right? She's talking about poetry. as a kind of generative concept of the contained, this kind of plural opacity, what Anna Hayden-Ersessian might term a utopia limited, has some utopian boundlessness, but also limits, right? Here I'd like to conclude, by turning to Percy Shelley's defense of poetry, here to think not only about the historical dimensions of Levine's thinking, right? Who are her kind of comrades historically, right? To think political and aesthetic dimensions together, configurations in that way. But also to think about this question of the boundless contacting the bounded, or the limits and the unlimited coming into contact or adjacency, the infinite, the finite, right? So let's look at the Shelley to end, which is this idea, kind of to Miranda's point, of the poet as reformer, as reforming, right, in both senses, aesthetic and political, or the reformation. Dante and Milton were both deeply penetrated with the ancient religion of the civilized world, and its spirit exists in their poetry, probably in the same proportion as its form survived in the unreformed worship of modern Europe. The one preceded and the other followed the reformation at almost equal intervals. Dante was the first religious reformer, and Luther surpassed him rather in the rudeness and acrimony than in the boldness of his censures of papal usurpation. Dante was the first awakener of entranced Europe. He created a language in itself, music and persuasion, out of a chaos of inharmonious barbarisms. He was the congregator of those great spirits who presided over the restoration of learning, the Lucifer of that starry flock which in the 13th century shone forth from Republican Italy as from a heaven into the darkness of the benighted world. His very words are instinct with spirit. Each is a spark, a burning atom of inextinguishable thought, and many yet lie covered in ashes of their birth, and pregnant with a lightning which has yet found no conductor. And this is really the line that I want to key in on. All high poetry is infinite, and yet it's an acorn. It is as the first acorn which contains, so a container, but all oaks, potentially. Veil after veil may be undrawn in the most inmost naked beauty, of the meaning never exposed. A great poem is a fountain, some kind of bounded material object, but one forever overflowing with the waters of wisdom and delight. And after one person in one age has exhausted all its divine effluence, which the peculiar relations enable them to share, another and yet another succeeds, and new relations are ever developed, the source of an unforeseen and unconceived delight. So it is actually all about relations in this interesting way. So that's where I'll end. But, thank you. Yeah.
So thank you for being here, and thank you, Professor Levine, for being here and being part of this very exciting roundtable. And a joy of being the fourth speaker is to be repetitive. So I'm going to repeat some of the things that you've already heard. To begin with, I want to compliment you on your book and repeat that it is a commendable book. And for me, the brilliance of forms lies in its new formalism, making visible once again the importance of form as a category and a concept for literary and cultural analyses, but also, just as importantly, for the analysis of the social. And Professor Levine sets up her project right at the outset of the book, stating, is there any way beyond or outside form? And she says there is, but she goes on to insist that formless or anti-formal experiences have actually drawn too much attention in literary studies. And the field has been so concerned with breaking forms apart that we have neglected to analyze the major work that forms do in our world. We have learned to look for places where form breaks down or dissolves, generating possibilities, leading to sort of the ambiguous and the ill-defined. But this is not enough for too strong an emphasis on form's dissolution has prevented us from attending to the complex ways that power operates in a world dense with functioning forms. Now, I work largely with Marxist theory, so to put this very boldly, this is music to Marxist ears. Because for decades, Marxists have been crying hoarse about the need to, of course, think agency and transgression. These are very important issues. But to also see how agency is circumscribed by structure. And this book, if you will allow me a Derridean conceit, is Structure Speaking Back to Play. So Victorianist revenge in modern movement. That's my other way of thinking about it. So even as literary scholars have over the last several decades read and obsessed with the ludic and tried to unthink the structurality of structures, forms have persisted and have continued to shape lives and livelihoods in very decisive ways. Forms, and now I mean the book, is a call to remember forms in literary and cultural studies, but also in the world we live in. And this powerful jog to the memory remains for me the single most important intervention that this book makes. And in the comments that I have, I take the insights of the book to think about my own work and to think aloud the book and the propositions the book makes, and raise a few questions, which I hope to talk to you about. And just again, mention this speaks to what Miranda was talking about. Like, we're all formalists in one way or the other. And I think of the Marxist critical tradition as a tradition of historical formalism, which actually does not kind of treat these two as two separate categories, but are in a sense dialectically united. And that's kind of the back of what I have to say. So as I read forms, I was struck by how much I kept reading the term form in my head as structure, but also as norm, which is kind of an adjacent category. Forms are structures of thought and feeling. They're also norms of thoughts and feelings. So I wonder what the triangulation of the category form, by bringing these two adjacent terms, would do to the term form itself. And as I say this, I'm quite aware that structure is different from norm. There's a certain thingness to structure. But when I think of norm, I think of limits and extents. And, you know, this is evident in good form, bad form, you know, what can be said, what should be said. Nevertheless, I think of all these terms working in similar ways because they set up conditions of possibility. Especially conditions of possibility of action, and this also speaks to your talk on infrastructure, which you know reminds me of the base, and you know to be reductive for a second, set up the superstructure and those kinds of things. I like it. Or if one wants to be a little more cynical, conditions of possibility for the staunching of action, just as likely. And here, and this goes back to your example of redlining yesterday, I think. And here I would want to also bring into focus a different and a specific kind of form, structure, norm, however you want to think of it, the idea of the law, which actually kind of sets limits, but there's a form to it, which provides a specific kind of affordance to the world we live in. And I, of course, think of form and structure a lot in my own work, and the structure that interests me most is what it gets called the capitalist mode of production, which I think of as a set of constitutive relations, a set of forms that structure human interactions. But these relations or forms themselves aggregate into a whole. So they're both many and one at the same time. And this brings me to the second thing that I've been thinking about as I read your book, and this is the question of scale. So how do we think of nested forms, forms that combine into larger forms, or forms, to just go back to Michael's example of Shelley's term, the acorn, which contains, in a sense, a set of possibilities for the future. So it is a form which holds into it, if you will, forms that may be actualized. They need not actualize, but there are certain utopian possibilities, if you will. And to just say this in another way, in a more kind of theoretically nerdy way, think of forms in relation to levels of abstraction. Where do we stop when we are abstracting? How do we stop? How do we therefore read a scale into the question of form? And here I'm thinking of both aesthetic forms and social forms. So, for instance, plot, characterization, focalization, space, time, which combine to form a narrative. So we move up from one set of forms to another form into a specific kind of narrative, a realist narrative, or a magic realist narrative. So we have different kinds of form working. And And this, I think, Marx does very well in his study of the commodity form, which he reads as a contradictory unity of labor and capital, and which he then scales up to think of the world as structured by this contradictory unity in different ways. Labor of production versus the labor of reproduction, social reproduction, sort of which takes often the shape of gendered labor. Again, something that you mentioned yesterday, so I'm just kind of thinking with you here. And then, as some of us have already mentioned, I was really struck by your focus on affordances. The book was persuasive for me in showing the work forms do in literature and in society. And with that, I was also thinking about older theorizations of form, and I'm here thinking also of form as genre. So genres performing a certain kind of ritualistic function in society, a contingent solution to a historical problem, which is then effected, that solution is effected in literature. Burke comes to mind, and the work of, you know, Jameson, but also the ideology of the aesthetic. So a set of theorizations. So in a sense, I'm here wanting to think about how your work, your new formalism that you posit, speaks to these kind of other commentaries on the work forms do in society and for society. And yet at the same time, as I